Hello and welcome to Joe's Boys. This is a podcast for little women, little men, and everyone in between. I'm your host, Peyton Thomas. I'm the author of the novel Both Sides Now. I'm also a writer for publications like Pitchfork, Billboard, and Vanity Fair. And I'm here today with my very special guest, Leo Min. Leo is the author of the novel Beating Heart Baby, which was named one of the best books of 2022 by BuzzFeed, Publishers Weekly, BookPage, Kirkus Reviews, and the Chicago Public Library, among others. Their writing has appeared in Nylon, Fader, Catapult, and many more. And they've interviewed all of your faves. I'm talking Mitski, Japanese Breakfast, Rina Sawayama, Caroline Polachek, Soccer Mommy, just to name a few. Leo, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm doing okay. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's fabulous to have you here. This episode has been a long time in the making. So what is your relationship to Little Women?
I definitely read it when I was a kid. I did not really engage with it that much more than any other book at the time, I would say. But because I knew I was going to be on this podcast soon, I read this story of essays about tomboyism called Joe's Boys. Forget the name of the editor. But yeah, basically it was excerpts of writing and poetry that were... Poetry is writing. Well, I mean like novels and memoirs and poetry and stuff like that. About tomboyism and then also different stages of life tomboyism.
Yeah.
So that was really cool.
Can you send that to me? I've never heard of that.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Yeah, it was just one of those things where, Little Women's on the mind. I don't think I otherwise would have sought it out, but it's definitely interesting. And I ended up being floored by the ways in which it approached it, I guess. The ways in which tomboyism was structured throughout as a stage of life thing. Yeah, it was cool. And it was also like a chance to read real literature, which for the first time in a while. That's not true. I have been reading real literature, but just not of that real nature. I've been reading a lot of sci-fi recently.
Yeah.
So that was cool. Yeah. But otherwise, haven't really touched it at much. I've watched various adaptations over the years. And, it's a story that a lot of people are familiar with. Once upon a time, I knew a lot more about it. And now I have a chance to think about it a little bit more deeply, but also not deeply, as we will talk about.
Yes, because as you were, what were you saying? Anime, some of these animes that we're going to discuss here are
mid at best.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's life.
That's life. So I found the anthology that you're talking about, I think. So it's called Joe's Girls.
Yes. Sorry, I'm just thinking about this. I was like, Joe's Boys. Yeah.
So Joe's Girls. Tomboy Tales of High Adventure, True Grit, and Real Life. It's a collection of fiction and memoir that looks at what it has really meant to be a tomboy from the 19th century to the present, and what the refusal to turn into a young lady has implied. So I'm seeing Willa Cather, Sandra Cisneros, Colette, Simone de Beauvoir, Ursula K. Le Guin's in here. Like, this looks very cool. I'm going to be checking this out. So, and also I recommend that to our readers as well. It sounds like it's more just about tomboyism than Joe specifically, but...
Yeah, I think that they took the archetype of Joe as a starting point to build the collection. And it was cool to read. They basically do a sampler, one of those old school mixed CD samplers for a label or something. All Joe girls. I will say something that was pretty funny reading it casually. The relationship between tomboyism in literature and horses is so strong.
Yes.
Half of these stories are about horses. And I'm like, damn, okay.
And that's funny because Alcott has said in the interview, in fact, right before she says, I feel as though I am by some freak of nature, a man's soul in a woman's body. She says, I feel like I was a horse in a past life. And people have made light of that and saying, well, that discredit, that shows how serious she was being about saying that she was a man's soul in a woman's body. But fun fact, Alcott actually believed in reincarnation. So it was... tongue in cheek, but it was also sincere. Anyway, well, what we're talking about today, before we get into the anime of it all, which March sister are you? And keep in mind, for the purposes of this podcast, Lori is a March sister.
Okay. I feel like the easy choice, again, because I have not thought that deeply about this for a very long time, is to just go with Joe because writer for writer. I don't know. I feel like I got a little bit of Amy, though.
Little bit, yeah.
A little bit of Amy vibes. She's got some stuff going on. I unfortunately can relate to some of this in some ways, but it's not about family. It's about the world. Yeah. That's sufficiently vague enough that I don't have to back it up. So
it's been advanced that everyone is a blend of two March sisters. Mm. So if you're a Joe son, Amy Moon. I think that makes a lot of sense. But now, since we're talking about your fabulous book, which Marge sister is Santi and which one is Sua?
Oh, God. Sue is obviously a Joe. Does that make Santi a Lark? Maybe.
I kind of think, yeah. I think the dynamic maps onto them.
Yeah. Wow. It's a fascinating way of thinking about it. Okay. Now I know what this... Now a couple people, I need to text that too. Just be like, I just had a breakthrough this morning.
Yeah.
But I think that scans, which is funny.
Well, with the exception of it's requited in your book more than Joe and Laurie, there's no requited. Sure.
Yes.
So now in a normal episode, this is where I'd ask you to recap today's chapter for us. But this is a special scrap bag episode and it's all about anime, Little Women in anime, Louisa May Alcott in anime. Let's get into it. First of all, what is anime?
Okay, so anime is and isn't the same thing as animation, where I would say the specific part of it that makes it its own fun little subcategory is the nationalistic aspect of it. The anime industry is settled. I mean, on actually a lot of fronts. I said that as a catch-all for it's based in Japan, but it certainly does, as with all media products of places, it does have parts of it that are steeped in iconography that, depending on how it's used, can or cannot be vectors, light cultural vectors of imperialism. So that's a part of it. It's a whole thing about how rising sun iconography used in animation, or like anime. People are like, are we still here? Is this still where we are? But that's its own thing. We're going to table it for now.
Yeah.
The big thing is that in the same way that you have the U.S. entertainment industry is built in these conglomerates and they have these long histories, that there are studios and figures within anime that have that same canonical, this is how we built our industry, this is the way that the industry works, these are the pathways that you take as an animator, specifically in the anime industry. I would say that the thing that people outside of anime are most familiar with probably are the eyes, the anime eyes, and the anime style, which is the stereotype that comes to mind as soon as I said that, but it's also much broader than that. And yeah, I don't know. I feel like in the beginning, there's entanglement between the impact of Disney abroad and then also the ways in which something like an Astro Boy, someone like Osamu Tezuka blew open the translation and then the foundation of its own thing. So it's very simplistic to say that anime exists because of Disney, but that's also not true in some ways. And a lot of, as we'll talk about, a lot of early anime was based off of Western, not fairy tales, but Western canonical literature, children's literature. One of the first productions that Hayao Miyazaki of Studio Ghibli ever worked on was like an anime of Heidi, the Girl in the Alps.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I'm pretty sure it's him I'm talking about. It might be someone else, but I'm 99% sure it's Miyazaki that worked on Heidi. Yeah. So the relationship between anime and children's media or children's storytelling has been there from the very beginning. Obviously, that's not all it's been used for. If you've ever had the fortune of walking past a car covered in stickers of anime girls, you know that it is not just for kids. Yeah, apparently the Japanese word for that type of car is called itasha, which literally means cringe car, which I think, or like painful car, which I think is very funny. Yeah. Also, we'll need to fact check that. But I am, again, 99% sure that is the case.
So what I can fact check for you is that, yes, Hayao Miyazaki did, and Hayao Miyazaki, the auteur of anime, like far and away, the director of Spirited Away, which was the first anime to win Best Animated Film, the Oscars. He's a legend. It doesn't look like this Heidi adaptation, which is from the 1970s, is really of the quality that we would expect from Miyazaki.
I mean, you know,
Starting out, he was doing scene design, layout, and screenplay for this. It was, interestingly, this was the company that, it was produced by the same company that would later make one of the Little Women adaptations that we're talking about today. So
yeah, the style is very, very similar.
So thank you for that breakdown of what anime is and how cringe it is to cover your car in anime stickers. But in addition to just anime in general and the many ways that Little Women has been represented in anime, like, it's just more broadly popular in Japan. It was a special favorite of Empress Michiko, who visited Orchard House, the Louisa May Alcott House Museum, in 1987. And personally wanted to sit at the desk where Louisa May Alcott wrote Little Women. So there's a longstanding history of deep love for Little Women in Japan, expressed in the anime that we're going to be talking about today. So there's 1981 Little Women's Four Sisters, which is directed by Kazuya Miyazaki, the 1987 Love's Tale of Young Grass, directed by Fumio Kurokawa, and a sequel anime, Tale of Young Grass, Nan and Miss Joe, which was based on Little Men and Joe's Boys. That was directed by Kozo Kasuba. And then most recently, the manga slash anime slash, it sounds like full-blown cultural phenomenon, Bungo Stray Dogs, which is of the past 10 years, in which Louisa May Alcott herself appears as a character. So we have a lot to discuss, Leo. Where should we begin?
So what I will say is that the first two slash two plus adaptations, the earlier ones,
yeah,
they're pretty faithful in terms of the actual, this is the story and that we are adapting it versus what happens in Stray Dogs. The style again is that older, that softer anime style, the version of it that is aesthetically fetishized by a lot of people. This is the anime look for that soft pastel cottage core, nature core version of the world. And I had an inkling that the Heidi thing was related because the style was too similar for the older one. Yeah, but they're basically the Ghibli versions, the not Ghibli versions of the story and how it's adapted.
Yes.
And it's not trying to necessarily push any sort of story boundaries.
I think maybe we'll start with the first one, which is 1981, Little Women's Four Sisters. That one is a very faithful adaptation of the story. I don't think it's very emotionally complex. From the episodes I watched, it was hard to even distinguish the sisters' personalities at times. They're just trying to do good and help people in their community.
Yes.
The animation style, it's these painted backgrounds that the character sort of are animated and move around in.
Yeah.
They do a very fun rig of the play scene, which in the book it's in the girls' living room. It's just very casual and they're putting it on. But in this anime, they have a full venue and the whole town has showed up to see the play and they're hammering these massive sets together. So it's a bit heightened in that way, but it's very faithful. It did seem kind of low budget.
It's hard to make this because the way that we think about quality of animation and the what is it, the limitations of the time too, where there's a portion of it that to me reads just as charming.
Oh, sure,
you know, But I think that the focus was spent on more of making sure that there was a cohesive look versus the intricacies that we associate now where taking a lingering moment, building it out to be like its own beautiful little gifable moment.
Right.
But the amount of time and effort that is spent on these shows, I think, has just gone up sharply over the years.
Yeah.
And does it stand the test of time? It kind of just stands outside of time.
Yeah, I think so.
And it's very charming and it very much has that, not to say that the anime girl effect is applies as much here. But kind of, it's just the ultra flattening of girlhood into something that's very specific. Normally, as we'll talk about later, in the productions that people associate with big popular anime now, they take the only girl syndrome and turn it into its own beautiful art form. But in this case, it's like when you have a lot of distinct girl characters, but again, the whole feeling is like very charming and very, oh, this is just Little Women, but it's like the Little Women aesthetic.
Lots of lovely painted countryside scenes. Sorry, go ahead.
It's the version of Little Women that if you imagine a Little Women anime, that would be exactly that in some ways.
Yeah.
Literally what it is.
It's not innovating a lot. I will say when you're speaking about anime girl syndrome, I mean, Joe March in this anime has bright yellow hair down to her ass and big blue eyes. And it's a much more feminine Joe, even than the second anime that we'll discuss. Yeah. So, I mean, she's still shown kind of cross-dressing in the play, but I don't get so much of a sense of Joe as this ultra tomboy, I think, in this particular adaptation.
Yeah.
Which is, it's sort of a bummer. I only watched the episode with the play. I don't know if you watched others.
And I watched a couple mixes of clips. I was kind of scene hopping. But, you know, it's the patience that one has to watch this kind of thing. This is something that actually, what was the production schedule of this? I imagine it aired like a regular episodic thing.
Yeah.
So
I can pull that up for you.
Yeah.
This was in 1981. So this was the earlier version. I will just hold on a second. I'm going to do some Googling here to get the information in front of us. So it aired on TV. It was episodic and it aired, I think, over the course of a few months. It was eventually syndicated. Yeah. So it aired from April to September in 1981. There were 26 episodes. It did get syndicated throughout Japan, throughout the United States even. But yeah, there's an English dub. I found at least some episodes on YouTube if you're interested in checking this out. But again, I think it's not a surprise to me that it was adapted again a few years later. And even then, the leap in obvious budget and scope is very different. Tales of Little Women is 48 episodes running over the course of a year. This one was only 26. And then there was, of course, the sequel anime to the second one. So yeah, this is, it looks to me much more very classic 80s anime.
Yes.
The development of the art still.
Yeah. Looking at it now, especially just because you're right, the leap in it where it's the proto Ghibli version. And then the next one is straight up looks like the Ghibli-fied version of that.
So. Well, yeah, it's because Miyazaki was coming into his power over this period of time. The look of anime was changing a lot. We don't see as much of the color palette here. It's very dark compared to the second version.
Yeah.
The mood, not necessarily. The mood is very like that. But it's a lot of these dark, kind of gloomy winter scenes. There's, I guess, offsetting the very buoyant tone of the scenes with the March sisters is Lori's grandfather is a cartoon villain who we only see in shadow and barking orders at people. So I guess that does a good sense of really establishing the difference between the two environments. But I think it's sort of, this was an early start, something to be improved, that we would see improved upon maybe, depending on how you look at it. But yeah, certainly extremely faithful to the book. The third episode is called Joe's Boyfriend, which I hope is sarcasm. Because we eventually get, later on, I think, Joe sort of figures out her authorship and becomes more independent. But
yes.
Yeah, so it's an interesting thing to check out just as an artifact, if nothing more, for true Little Women heads. I will say I found this and Tales of Little Women. I have enjoyed anime. As you may not know, I have some favorite series. I found this a little bit tedious. I think it is for very young audiences.
Oh, yeah. It's for very young audiences. And it's also a version of encountering the material that you already kind of know.
Yeah.
And so either it's taking you exactly where you know you're going to go, or it's taking you on a journey beyond the source and then kind of playing with the characters as the archetypes. Basically, they're little doll versions of themselves. And you just are playing with your own story for at least the second one, or the second plus one. So,
yeah. Well, let's get into that second one now. So we've discussed the 1981 version, the 1987 adaptation, which was, it sounds, when we say Little Women anime, this is the one that comes up first. It's about double the length of the first version. The art style is very different. It's clear that more money was spent, although maybe not much more. But the fascinating thing, this one is really interesting to me because they take massive liberties with the story.
Yeah.
So I think the biggest change is that the Marches begin living near Gettysburg in Pennsylvania. So at the outset of the story, they live in Pennsylvania and Mr. March is home from the war. It's a brave choice because all of these other, the book itself hinges on the dad's away and we're waiting for him. He comes home in the first episode here. I'm not sure why the narrative utility of him being home, but he's home and he goes out with the family on a picnic, at which Joe, who is much more of a tomboy, she's really rendered in that kind of shonen hero. she has a shonen boy face and then there's a ponytail attached. That's how I read it. Anyway, so she climbs a tree and sees a Confederate army nearby, which, okay. And then, so Mr. March is like, uh-oh. So actually, it's when I say that they're a bit tedious, after Joe spots the Confederates nearby, that's not enough. And she and her father have to go on a scouting expedition just to confirm that they're there and burn up another 5 minutes of runtime.
Yeah. This stuff is expensive. All animation period is expensive. Yeah. And it truly boggles my mind sometimes how they choose to spend that time and money. Reusing frames and stuff like that, that makes sense to me. But then they'll take a moment and then draw it out in a way where I'm like, it doesn't need to be that long maybe, but you had commitments. Yeah. the joke that we always have in our household is imagine like an animator coming home from work. And it's in the service of dear diary. Today, I made a pair of titties bounce particularly buoyantly, you know, two big water balloons flying in the opposite directions.
Water balloon.
But in this case, today I animated part of a civil war interspersed with the classic story Little Women in a way that is adventurous, but it's also a textbook version of adventurous, the most standard version of adventure that you can, I guess, put together. Again, the anime girl thing where are a tomboy, it has to be taken up to the biggest possible level.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. It's an effort to like inject some action into the beginning by saying, it's not just, oh, dad's away at war. It's, oh, no, the war is here. The war is on our doorstep. And I guess the only issue then is it becomes pacing because they spot the Confederates in the first episode. By the second episodes, the Confederates have fully just taken over the town and the Little Women are still kicking around. And in particular, Joe is like, okay, well, I hope that the fighting doesn't get too bad because I want to go to this dance and wear my new dress. And I mean, that's... First of all, in what world is that Joe March? Secondly, just from a story logic point of view, I think in the second episode, the Confederates have taken over the town and the Marches are talking about leaving. They will eventually move to Massachusetts and then kind of the regular events of Little Women will begin. But there's a good five episodes where they're still in Gettysburg and talking about moving soon. And we're spending a lot of time on Beth has a new kitten. We're getting these dresses ready to go for the dance. I'm really not sure about this one, guys. I mean, it's what's fascinating about it, though, along with the choice to kind of more firmly situate it in the center of the Civil War with the Confederates, not only on their doorstep, but actually invading their home at some points, is that we get actual Black characters in this adaptation. The character of Hannah is rewritten as a Black character, like a free Black woman who's working for the Marches as a housemaid. And there's also a really, I think, daring sequence that's of a young man named John who's escaping from slavery. And he hides out in the Marches' shed, at which point I don't like that he sort of kidnaps Beth and holds her hostage for a minute. It's not the portrayal of a free Black man that I would have chosen. But the situation is very quickly de-escalated by Marmy coming in and being like, no, you're safe. We're not going to let anything happen to you. They hide him while the Confederates storm through the house and look for him. And he's able to safely escape to freedom. And Hannah has a lot of agency. She gets to kind of be the voice of, you know, why the Confederates are so hateful and why it's so important to her that young man be freed. At the same time, though, some of Beth's dolls are blackface dolls.
I was like, how does one approach the history of...
Well, exactly. It's a very complicated history. This is not even just the portrayal of Black people and slavery in Western media. This is a whole other can of worms, right?
I don't know if we have time to like get fully into it, but
we
it's
have
just
time.
Like, okay. Basically, the portrayal of Black characters in cultures in which there is a more nebulous racial makeup, or not even nebulous, but you have a very large, dominant, homogeneous. Oh my God. I do say words out loud sometimes. Population. And then they don't have the very clear historical divide in the same way as, and also the history is much longer and more complicated. Actually, that's not true. It's much longer. I mean, there's been more history in most countries besides America. I feel like we can all say this very certainly. And so the relationship between Blackness versus whiteness and what is the dominant characteristic or something like that is very different. But when you take on a Eurocentric point of view or Eurocentric style, which I would say a lot of early animation is, again, indebted to maybe not the Disney look per se, but the Disney version of taking stories. And I wasn't prepared to answer Well, I wasn't prepared to talk about this in depth, in the sense of it being the ways in which not even blackness, but just like skin tone rendering and stuff like that, where the literal tone diversity of characters is like its own fraught little thing. And you do see this in Western animation, obviously. But then once this is exported, literally exported over, and then the ways in which it's been codified within the aesthetic space of this industry itself, it can get a little weird. Is it a better or worse take on the story? The story itself is a capital G good representation, or like a good intentioned, I would say.
Oh, completely. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, where oftentimes you bump into these archetypes or stereotypes in the world of the story where you're like, it thinks that it's good, but it's actually bad, or it is bad and it knows it's bad. And in this case, it wants to be good. It's trying to do good, and it just cannot reconcile the what it is that it's doing with the goodness that it proclaims to be doing, and then the reality of the world that they're in. And like, part of me is trying to like jump through the hoop of like, is it a good choice to reflect blah, blah, blah of the time? But I don't think it's that deep, probably. If someone who worked on this production would like to climb out of the woodwork and be like, no, this is exactly what we meant, or like exactly what we're doing. But yeah, it's funny. On the one hand, one has to applaud them for doing this in, what is it, 1980?
This was 1987. Yeah.
And on the other hand, it's not consistent because it didn't have to be consistent. It was already an anomaly in some ways that it was doing this at all. That said, it's always very funny to hear about these big historic events filtered through the gaze of... But there's a lot of literature and stuff like that. But when you've tried to fold it in as the backdrop for like your otherwise lighthearted coming of tale thing, coming of age tale, coming of tale. Yeah. Where I'm like, tonally, it wants to thread the needle of being this cute thing and then also tackling these big things. But the tone, when it's trying to maintain that kind of consistency or that slice of life quality, when you're talking about big stuff like that, then the big stuff comes in as either more straight up moralization, or it gets turned into these elaborate set pieces that have nothing. Like, you're like, where's what is this? What am I actually taking in? I don't know. Cutification of history.
Yeah, in the same way that I'm sure if I tried to summarize any episode of Japanese history right now, I'm sure it would sound just as disjointed and off the dome as in their rendering of the Confederates occupying a town and looking for enslaved people would be.
Yes.
I do think, as you said, it's very moralistic. It's big set pieces that either overwhelm the story or kind of get shunted to the background. In particular, the search for the Confederates sweeping the house for John takes over an entire episode, and that's the whole thing. Whereas in other situations, the imminent, not even just threat, but Confederates have occupied your town. They've hung the stars and bars from the flag at City Hall, and we are still dealing with a new kitten and like trying to go to the dance. The priorities get very weird. And for as much as I do think that Hannah is an emotionally complex character, I think that she gets to offer a lot of very nuanced insight, not even just for the time, but for any kind of Civil War media. It's a recurring thing that we talk about, that issues of race in the Civil War are not present in the original Little Women to a huge extent. And they've similar been kind of whitewashed out of subsequent adaptations. Here, it's more front and center than, I don't know about front and center, it's in there. You know, it has a more prominent role than I think we're used to seeing. By the same token, I just had to look it up while we're talking, and the voice actors for both of the Black characters here are white people.
This is a standard-ish thing. I don't know. Yeah. Or something that you run into is just, the ways in which voice actor diversity and that kind of thing and that alignment of representation, you see it in Western animation now. It is important in terms of the ways in which who's working, right? Who's working on something, even if they're not the actual face of it, you always want that space to be as wildly populated as possible. Wildly is not the word, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And then the reality of what it actually affects is a little bit different in that point then, where it's more about equity. It's more about having the bodies actually be there. And it's more about, I think this comes up a lot with accents and stuff like that, obviously. But then as far as what, I don't know if anime has had that same reckoning for a variety of reasons. And it certainly was not something that was going to be happening for the 80s.
Yeah. Sorry, I should emphasize. So all of the voice actors in the original Japanese Nippon Animation production were Japanese.
Yeah.
Right. Not getting any black people.
Oh, sorry. But I should have backed this up by saying, no, the people that were like working on specifically like porting over outside media, that community, that was probably not super diverse.
No. Yeah, they were not thinking about it at all, no. I'm sure, because that's where every voice actor in the English dub produced for it aired on HBO, it sounds, and another network called Smile of a Child. So I'm sure they were not thinking about, you smile the smile of a child. I take it that's okay. They do a lot of anime.
No, I just, that's such a cute and somewhat ominous name.
Yeah.
It's like aggressively cute. Yeah.
Yeah. They were not thinking about the conversation, like, let's get some black people in the room to voice these black characters, was simply not being had. So,
no.
I mean, that it's so difficult because I think some of the writing here is genuinely very sophisticated. And some of it is, I'm sorry, the Confederates are sweeping your house and Joe March is like, I need a new dance for the ball, please. No, in what world? So, yeah. It's wacky. I haven't, how much of this did you watch?
I watched, again, parts of it. It's a lot of this stuff is floating around because it hasn't been licensed. The licensing or whatever is not up to date. So whatever you can find on YouTube for the most part, right? And the big thing for me was the ways in which the characters move about and stuff like that. There's clearly somebody wanted to make Little Women and they wanted to use Little Women as an actual, they weren't just saying it's Little Women, but I do think the fact that it's Tales of, where it's, okay, this is the starting point. This is how we want to move the story along. And it's in a way where I feel like if you are coming at it and you're like, oh, I wanted to see like a more sophisticated animeification of Little Women, this is the style that you would think of, but for all of the things that you mentioned, it's not quite that, in ways that are good / interesting and in ways that are probably very, infuriating.
No. It's mostly interesting. I think the choice specifically to locate the beginning of it in the center of the battle in the Civil War, that tells me a lot about how the Civil War is viewed in Japan. I think we can learn a lot just about how American history is viewed internationally. At the same time, I said this with the last one, but I really tried to watch as much of this as I could. It's made for very young children. It's not, the pacing is very weird. I wouldn't recommend it necessarily to like adult viewers, but you know, it is interesting to see the license that they take. The Professor Bear becomes this rival reporter that Joe has an antagonism with, which sounds fun to me. It sounds like Joe's newspaper career becomes a very prominent part of the story later on. Of course, the transliterations of these episode titles is extremely funny. It's like, father is dying, dot, dot, dot. Joe sells her hair, exclamation point. Or, don't die, exclamation point. Amy has fallen in the river. So some of it is very funny, but it's hard to watch as an adult. I'll just say that.
What is the thing? There was something that flashed in my head for a second as you were saying that. Yeah, this is the version of it that this is like the exciting version of it.
Yeah.
And so the thing that I was going to say is that I maybe should have reread Little Women before, because I'm not as attuned to the differences, but there are things that I did notice where it's like, dad's back. Dad's here. But the tone of it is very much the fun, spunky girls' adventure that happens to be set in the Civil War. Not just ambiently, like it is set in the Civil War.
Yeah.
But then the way that it's framed is being about the family and all this stuff.
Yeah.
Which is, I wonder if this is a license that only a non-US based production would probably make those choices.
Yeah. I get the sense that just the issues of slavery are still kind of radioactive because they don't show up even in the recent versions with Maya Hawke and Saoirse Ronan, and we just don't see a lot of that. So I'll set that aside. I'll say that this version does a lot. It improves on the 1981 version that the characters, the girls, are much more differentiated.
They're real.
Both in style and demeanor. Amy in particular, Amy is like the protagonist and narrator for the first little while. The funniest thing, we've talked about this on the show before, but in the books, Amy basically gets in trouble for drawing a mean caricature of her teacher. And in this one, she draws a drawing of the teacher that is so nice that the teacher congratulates her. And I'm like, yes, as Amy is the narrator of life, she says, so my painting was so good that the teacher loved it. So I think the first episode is a fun watch if you just want to get a feel for the vibe of this. I think that Joe especially is much more of a fun tomboy, and she has a lot of fun physicality in her animation. So I think this is the stronger of the two. I did not investigate Little Women 2, Joe's Boys, aka Tale of Young Grass, Nan and Miss Joe, but I think it speaks to the popularity. The previous version, this they came back in 1993 and did this, and it's a take on Little Men and Joe's Boys, which I have said this before. At this point, I have not read Little Men or Joe's Boys. I'm saving them for the podcast, so I'm not qualified to speak on that. I don't know if you looked into any of the sequel anime or...
No, same thing. I just looked up clips. Yeah, I mean, it's also real. Again, not as familiar with the story. So I can't say whether it's faithful or not. But the animeification, it lends everything like that. The way everything looks is warm and cute. And that is first and foremost the impression that you get. I would say the first one is also cute, but it's just a different kind of cute.
Yeah.
Like different subcategory of cute.
Yeah. The first one is very slow moving, beautifully painted backdrops, almost ambient in a way. And then the 1987 version is like very peppy and upbeat, and they're hanging in there, even though the Confederates are down.
Yeah. The style is very much, it's brighter, it's more buoyant, it's more reflective of what you think about when you think of classic storybook animation across the board. I would say that this is probably also the same in actually. I cannot think of a single Western animation production that evokes this in my mind right now. So the 90s. I know they exist. I probably would be able to list it off if I thought of it a little bit harder. But I was thinking, like, what's a 90s Western cartoon? And it was King of the Hill. And I'm like, I don't know if that's the one I want to... I don't know if that's the one I want to base it about.
I would say the New Adventures of Winnie the Pooh.
Okay.
It's very similar in vibe, I think, and target audience. We're not,
exactly.
Not that the Confederate Army was a major presence in the New Adventures of Winnie the Pooh. The stakes are a bit higher. We're maybe 2 or 3 years above that in age range, but stylistically, tonally, I think they're very similar. Yeah. It's very that. So I guess that brings us now to the modern anime that we have to discuss, which is Bungo Stray Dogs. Leo, what the hell is this thing?
Okay. So as you're familiar with, but maybe not everybody listening with, there's a subcategory of anime that is called shonen anime, young men's anime, which is not always about young men, but most of the time it is. And the way that there's a certain subcategory of that, which is also like the supernatural powers based shonen anime.
Yes.
This is something that I speak with a lot of authority. So we're about to get into a little taxonomical thing. The other two, I'm like, this is a little bit outside of my time. I'm not as familiar with the history that's going that far back. But shonen anime, I can speak to, unfortunately, extremely deeply. So the way that a lot of these shows work is they'll take an idea and then just build it out to be like, this is just the central power or whatever. I don't think it's something that is quite the same as what's going on in comics and comic adaptations. Yeah. In a way that's, again, if someone wants to correct me on this and talk about how this is actually exactly the same thing, by all means, whatever. But there will always be a little card trick or a specific framework that your powers are based off of. So in something like, I'm just trying to think of another example. I guess DBZ Dragon Ball Z kind of does it in terms of using Buddhist history or using the iconography of that stuff as the basis for some stuff. And then something like Naruto with all elemental power. Actually, Avatar does this. The Avatar is also deeply indebted to anime. One Piece. I don't know enough about One Piece to talk with any authority about One Piece, but I have a bunch of examples ready to go and I can't think of them. But basically, the subcategorization that Bungo Stray Dogs uses for their powers is canonical literature in largely Japan, but then also the rest of the world. So
Bungo Stray Dogs translates literally into literary stray dogs. So all of the characters are famous authors.
Yes. Which is for a long time, I knew that the show existed. It was on the periphery of my anime consciousness. But then when you told me that this exists, actually was, I was like, look, how had I gone through decades of my life? I guess it hasn't been around for decades. Maybe it has been around for decades. It's been around for a while.
2012. It debuted in 2012 as a manga.
Okay, so a decade.
Yeah.
So how did I not know that there was anime Herman Melville walking around in the public consciousness, you know? It seems like such a specific intersection of what the hell? Oh, another example of what the powers whole thing is. Like, there's a series called Katekyo Hitman Reborn, and it's all like mafia tropes, mafia imagery, symbology, and then the powers are like all supernatural powers based on stuff like that. So
the premise, I just need to sum up it. Basically, from that cyclone of information, this is an anime about famous authors who are detectives, and they're trying to protect their town and eventually the world from the mafia. And as the show expands and goes on, we go to the United States and we meet the American superhero authors. We go to Russia. Fyodor Dostoevsky becomes a central character.
Yes.
It sounds like the Russians are villains, so that's geopolitically interesting.
Yes.
But so Louisa May Alcott is one of the characters that they meet. What's so funny, it's that same thing as the 1987 Little Women anime took major liberties with American history. One of these authors is named Francis Scott Key Fitzgerald, who is, of course, a fun blend of F. Scott Fitzgerald and Francis Scott Key, who are, in fact, different people. And then his superpower is the Great Fitzgerald rather than the Great Gatsby. So they're just like, whatever, man.
Yes. My favorite thing, the first episode that I watched was the one where they meet, or maybe it's not the first time they meet him, but it's John Steinbeck and H.P. Lovecraft. And to give you a sense of what the powers situation is like, John Steinbeck's powers is called Grapes of Wrath, I think. It might literally just be called that. And what happens is that he stabs himself and grapevines come out and they interface with nature.
Yeah.
So that's something that you're taking basically the reference to like another level in a way that I'm sure that there's analogs in Western media. But to me, it's like that's such an anime thing to do, or such a anime rendering of you have this idea and then you take it in both a very literal and also a very strange and more like utility based translation of that.
And some of these are very interesting. Margaret Mitchell is here, and her ability Gone with the Wind allows her to like manipulate wind. Nathaniel Hawthorne is the Scarlet Letter, and he can convert his own blood into words and use them as ink, right? And look, I'm just on Wikipedia here. Do you want to get, so Lucy Maud Montgomery, the author of Anne of Green Gables, her ability is called Anne of Abyssal Red, which I'm quoting Wikipedia here, allows her to create an alternate reality known as Anne's Room, in which people are imprisoned by a giant doll named Anne, which it's giving Squid Game to me.
The thing about it is that either they will, another thing about like the shonen anime pacing specific is that it's the things that they fixate on are in the same way that the second one, a tonal fixation, the tonal switches are very non-existent. The tonal switches and the ways that like characters interact here, where either you get a full arc kind of devoted to, or either like you get a full one-on-one fight between a secondary good character and a secondary bad character, in scare quotes, good and bad, or the interaction's over 5 minutes, but they spend that time to like drop this character in, drop all this lore about them, and then they're just gone. They may appear in the narrative one or two more times. So the fact that Louisa May Alcott has like a couple moments, you know, she basically plays like Francis Scott Key Fitzgerald. She's the main strategist for their group. And she's also kind of like an undersecretary in some ways.
Yeah, she's like a tactician.
Yeah, so she just kind of shows up. And if you're not familiar at all with any of these quote-unquote characters who are all, a lot of them are named after famous authors, you're just going to walk away from this being like, oh, I love Herman Melville. I've got my Herman, I keep coming back to Herman Melville because his power is literally like a giant floating fortress that's shaped like a white whale, which I'm like,
so good. It's so funny.
Yes.
So Louisa May Alcott is a character in this anime. The one last thing, the Russians come in and the name of the Russians group is Rats in the House of the Dead, which is extremely hardcore.
Super hardcore.
And I just want to highlight that that's incredibly cool. So anyway, Louisa May Alcott is a character in this anime. So her ability, Little Women, well, in again, in Japanese, it's Story of Young Grass. So it allows her to slow time down to 1/8,000th of regular speed while she is thinking alone in a private room. So in a way, this ties into, it kind of betrays some knowledge of Alcott's process, because when she wrote, she would just lock herself in her room for literally days on end. She would go without sleep or food and just churn out a whole book basically, and then collapse for a week. So, which was not, it was not a sustainable writing process, and it caused a lot of, you know, health issues later in her life, but that was how she'd do it. And so it's funny that I guess they knew enough to be like, okay, her ability is when she's alone in a private room, she can
make like these master sicko mode strategies. Yeah. Right. Which I don't know. Yeah. Sorry. Go.
No, that's all I have to say. It's just, they seem to be characters based on the authors. Louisa May Alcott doesn't look like Louisa May Alcott, and the Lucy Maud Montgomery character looks more like Anne of Green Gables than the real Lucy Maud Montgomery. So they're just very loosely based on the characters.
Yes. Yeah.
But one extremely funny thing, when we were doing our research and trying to get our heads around what this is, you said Louisa May Alcott is only in this thing for 2 episodes. Is that right?
She's in for a couple, but okay, she's ambiently around, you know?
Okay.
They'll have the group shots anytime, because F. Scott Keefe is he's the main villain for the arc, yeah. I think, of the second season, which might be like the second. This is too deep in the weeds for this. Anyway, so because he's around a lot and she's with him specifically, mm-hmm. they'll have a toss-up interaction. But the moments in which she's actually in the story are like 2 or 3 times, I think.
Okay.
Just enough.
So she's
for you
not
to
a
know.
Major
no,
character.
She's, I think that on the villains wiki, she is labeled as an insecure minion is her villain type.
No.
Which
oh, so she's a villain. She's a villain.
Oh, yeah. The guild is not good. Sorry. I had to know more about what this, because it's a huge show, apparently. It's a huge thing.
It's been on for a decade. It started as a manga, which is kind of anime style illustrations in books.
Usually it's manga first. But
sure, yeah.
Case,
so
yeah.
It began as manga.
Yeah.
It became an anime. We've had feature films. We've had YA novels based on this. And then again, I cannot emphasize enough, it's been a thing for over 10 years in Japan. So
yes.
It's a pretty big... So anyway, but you were saying she's a villain.
Yes.
She's evil.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The last piece of media that I consumed was watching the good guys save their city by... Actually, did they save their city? I watched... Moby Dick starts to fall on top of the city because they're going to destroy it. And also the thing that I thought was fascinating was throughout the show, characters have flashbacks, reading stuff that this book changed my life. Or I'm constantly thinking about this written quote. Instead of being like, oh, where is that from? They're like, what book is that from? And then the object that the Americans are there to like take is
right,
some
yeah.
apocryphal.
Apocryphal.
It's like this mysterious book. That's what they're after.
Yes.
Where it's like people are interested in literature, but it's funny to see it taken in this particular direction. Usually when historical figures are being played with it, like little dolls in other media, it's either some historical revisionism or like you're doing it for absurdity, yes. The way that Abraham Lincoln is in Adventure Time. But in this case, they're not. I use sexy not to be like physical descriptor, but they're not pop culturally sexy characters.
No. I get it. Yeah.
Yeah. Who is being like, I want to see Natty Hawthorne in being adapted or animeified?
Well, I'll tell you who. Daily.Montcott, who has committed to Daily as an Instagram account that is devoted to shipping the anime versions of Louisa May Alcott and Lucy Maud Montgomery. They've got, it looks like, over 100 memes at this point. We've got the lesbian flag in here.
Damn.
It seems that they do not interact in the anime, but this person is like, this is the hill that I'm dying on. They are gay. And it's just, I have not been into this scene since I was a literal child. And so it's very fun to see all kids are still up to these shenanigans.
All the things that you remember and adore about that time in your life are still very much present. I mean, you were saying, yes. I don't know if this is before we started recording, that you mostly watched Bungo AMVs to prep yourself.
I tried to find episodes on YouTube, and I guess the copyright mavens who let the Little Women stuff get through, Bungo Stray Dogs is currently airing, so you'd have to go to a streaming site for that.
Yes.
So all that I could find were like fan-made AMVs of Louisa May Alcott X, Francis Scott Key Fitzgerald. So people are out here.
I mean, that's the ship that makes the most sense, I guess, for her. Sorry, that's, I'm like, oh yeah, I can see that.
That's so too deep in it.
Yeah, I mean, the way that character is rendered is honestly, in terms of representative, it both is the most faithful in some ways because of specifically the Little Women power. And it's also the most insulting and the worst. Where the things that made the other productions, it's actually the story, right? And it's, they could not turn all of the Little Women into little boys in at least the actual adaptation of it. Because the whole point is that it's Little Women versus Louisa May Alcott is like stuttering and being extremely like, ooh, you know, it's it's not great. Very much anime girl. She's also very young. I think a lot of the characters are actually really young, which is also fast.
Oh, no.
They're basically turning all of their characters who were real people into a shoujo version of themselves.
Yeah. Well, I don't think problematically like young. I think we're looking at young women in men.
Yes. Yes. Well,
sexy, hot young women and men versions of Louisa May Alcott, et cetera.
Yeah. Which is, again, the gears. The gears are, wow.
Yeah, the galaxy brain of this. So comforting to know that time moves on and civilizations rise and fall. But a an internet user with the handle bloodyx_corpse is still out here.
Yeah.
I ship Louisa May Alcott and Lucy Maud Montgomery in this anime. It's
yes.
I think the approach it takes to we've been focusing on these American authors and Russian authors who've been kind of animeified, but you know, obviously the entire Japanese canon is represented here as famous authors as well.
Yes,
famous authors turned detectives, and I think it takes liberties with in the same way that Neon Genesis Evangelion. Which is kind of, it's the Citizen Kane of anime, if you will.
Wild claims. No, I like it. I like it.
Just the pinnacle, right? The best of the best. It takes similar liberties with Christian imagery and religious themes that this book is taking with the Western literary canon. It's just treating it with such a, it does not give a fuck.
It's the thing that I'm, again, 99% sure that this is the case. The reason that Eva is steeped in religious, Christian specifically imagery, like Judeo-Christian imagery, is because they were like, this looks cool. It's not meant to be like a broader commentary. So in this case where it's like, okay, clearly someone is enamored with the idea of literature and then wanted to in some ways pay homage and in some ways desecrate is too strong, but in some ways just really just mess with the idea of what that power could be reconfigured into and turn into actual supernatural powers that one has supernatural power battles with. At that point, you've committed, that's just going to be what it is.
And there's clearly an audience for it.
Yeah.
We have a manga, we have an anime, I'm looking at Wikipedia here. We have feature length theatrical films. We have a video game. I wonder if Louisa May Alcott is in the video game. I would love to see that. Stage plays, light novels. So it is huge. Is it an empire?
Yes, the Bungo Stray Dogs empire, which I'm always surprised by like how much stuff gets the full media mix treatment.
Yeah.
But then at the same time, I don't know. It's how in my own little bubble am I of my own curated taste and my own, shall we say, it's not even high standards. It's just like the stuff that comes up on your radar. There's just another world out there of stuff like that I hadn't encountered. And when I do encounter, there's a reason why I haven't seen it, you know, either reified or talked about in the same way. But yeah, it's so interesting. And it's funny to think about someone's first impression of the stuff that they ambiently know about culturally, then becoming this. I wonder like who's picking up Crime and Punishment because of Bungo Stray Dogs.
Someone is, right?
Yeah, maybe. Oh. And they're like, this isn't that at all.
I mean, I'm thinking of a series of unfortunate events, which all similarly played really fast and loose with literary references. I'm 8 years old reading a series of unfortunate events. I haven't read For Esme with Love and Squalor, but Esme Squalor is there and she's pointing to something kind of bigger, right, than the book is. So I think it's not so unusual. I mean, no, it is. This is a really weird concept, right? But it sounds like it's a lot of fun. It sounds like it's, I imagine probably literature teachers in Japan must love it because if you're trying to teach bored high schoolers, you're like, just like your favorite character in this anime, right? We can finally read the novel that is based on the superpower, right? So it might be a way of concealing the pill and the peanut butter for the dog kind of thing.
I think it's more, I feel like the attitude in anime in Japan is, depending on who you ask, either still outside of the main culture or not. The ways in which we pick up other international pop cultural products and like engage with it outside of it, in the same way that I have no idea what someone in Japan thinks American TV is.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's the part where I can't, on the one hand, it looks very popular. It seems like the what it is in pop culture seems so clear.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, someone, if any listeners in Japan, living in Japan, can talk about the contemporary state of anime in the culture. Because in the West, it's rising. Anime is ascendant. This is my little cola string in the doll catchphrase. Like, anime is ascendant in the culture.
No, it is. It is.
But I imagine it hasn't gotten weaker. But it's also the ways in which we see it folding in to our broader pop cultural scene is very different than if it's like your homegrown industry. Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, I feel like the only thing I can say authoritatively is it must be reasonably popular to have had so many adaptations and to be running for this long and, you know, to be on the fifth season.
Yeah.
But it's hard to say outside of that, how popular is this? Specifically, what is the role in the culture? Are teachers of literature in Japan using this to get people in the door?
Yeah.
So at the conclusion of this wide-ranging conversation, I can't say I would recommend either of the Little Women anime series beyond check it out on YouTube if you're curious and watch a few minutes. I can't get my head around Bungo Stray Dogs. Leo, is there any anime that you would recommend for fans of Little Women and maybe specifically listeners of this podcast who are maybe interested in gender nonconformity, queer and trans themes?
So there's a manga that I can recommend. I think it's called Our Dusk at Dawn. The Japanese name is Shimamani Tasogare, and it's told from the perspective of a young man who's realizing that he might not be straight. And then like it puts him in conversation with a lot of other characters who do know themselves, are sure of themselves, or questioning themselves. And it's a really beautiful, not necessarily coming of age story, but coming into yourself story. It's technically based in reality, but there are sequences that are kind of flights of fancy. So that's one that I like to recommend just because it runs the gamut of a lot of stuff. And it's also a really gentle and nice story. In terms of things that evoke the spirit of Little Women, I would say that most Ghibli Productions thread that needle of the spunky, maybe not always tomboy, but spunky group of girls, funny, interesting women in those worlds too. The non-Miyazaki Ghibli movie that I always beat the drum for is Only Yesterday, which is, again, it's not specifically queer centric or anything like that, but tonally, if you're into Little Women, I feel like that would be up your alley.
Yeah.
In terms of other stuff, I always joke that Naruto is like the most homoerotic story in anime, but I don't know if others would agree. And I also would not actually recommend that. But the things that like you're like, this is obviously gay. And then there's things that are like, is this actually canonically gay? Does it explore this world?
Yeah, yeah.
To me, Naruto, the series, is something. But that's more like you're going in the Bungo Stray Dogs version of consumption. What else? Yeah, I don't know. There's not that much stuff out there that is queer-centric that is specifically about... I'm trying to like thread the needle of both tone and subject matter.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the stuff that I'm interested in or that I think is gender interesting, gender funny, is not necessarily in the Little Women world tone. There's this series called Land of the Lustrous, Hoseki no Kuni. The characters are like canonically not gendered, and they're these gem beings, G-E-M beings.
Yeah.
And it's actually a really fascinating look at transhumanism, transcending the body and about the spirit and stuff like that, which is both not gay and also extremely gay. So straight up fantasy, big, weird, philosophically brutal fantasy, but it's also the way that you think about the body and the spirit, what constitutes a body and a spirit, feels very queer. At least in the manga, it's more, they're a lot more androgynous. In the anime, it's a little bit, they've been femized a little bit stronger, but visually, it's the best of a certain type of animation. I don't know. And I just think the story is nuts. The story is not gay, but it's like very gay. I don't know if I can recommend Aizawa work in good conscience, but her stuff is out there. Her stuff is out there. Nana, Paradise Kiss. That stuff is out there. And in some ways it's really good. And in some ways it's absolutely horrible. Nana specifically.
Okay.
Yeah. Although if you read Nana as a story of love between two women, it almost becomes good, but the heterosexual bullshit is off the chain. So it, I can't recommend
it. Down with good.
Yeah. In a way that I was like, Jesus, are we okay? And it's like, no. Yeah. I was always someone who has canonically gay trans characters in her work for a long time. So it's one of those things where technically it's there, but like, don't engage with it just for that.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. What else? And my recommendation is John Marco fan fiction. Okay, bye.
Wow. That's an old field. That's an old tilled field of the culture. Yeah. If you're going to get into the fanfic world, the world is your oyster. But as far as actual canonical work, it's a little bit harder to suss out. I know more gay stuff. Another serious, semi-serious recommendation I would make is Revolutionary Girl, Utena, U-T-E-N-A, where again, not at all like the content basis of a Little Women thing. It goes a lot of places. It gets really weird. That one can be hard to watch. I struggled through the first time, but the parts that are really cool and the things that they have to say about memory, the distortion of memory, trauma, the way that the mind processes trauma, the iconography is, even if you don't know it, you've probably seen some of its iconography floating around in the cultural ether, especially if you're into anime at all or like ambiently into that stuff at all. Yeah, it does get pretty heavy at times, but a lot of it is buried under metaphor. So you don't really realize what you've seen or like what you've watched. And then there's stuff that's actually just straight up very like, oh man, that's hard to watch. But in the context of the show, there's room. It's not just a thing that's done and then you're left to just not process it. All the show is all about processing. So in a way that, again, Aizawa stuff, I think it's superficially maybe gets into more literal representations of queerness that does not leave you room to process all the stuff that's going on versus Utena, horrific things happen both on screen and you're hinted at, but all that they're doing is processing the metaphor and then these highly stylized battles.
All right. Well,
yeah.
I mean, that from what I know about Utena, I think that's probably the closest up the alley of our listeners. But Leo has certainly, you've given us a ton to work with here, a lot to think about. Thank you so much for coming by for this very fun conversation.
Yes.
Where can people find you online and how can they support your work?
I am on Instagram at emo.ocean. And I'm also on Tumblr at emo.ocean, which is, I think,
brave,
the better thing. I mean, I have only ever had good experiences with flying under the radar on Tumblr, which I know is not the general experience for a lot of people. No. But no, that's where I encountered a lot of anime. That's where anime fandom, it is still very annoying. This is the thing about online spaces for anime stuff. A lot of it is too annoying. But on Tumblr, it's a little bit easier to filter out the noise and just focus on kind of what you're into, which is why I never encountered Bungo Stray Dogs on there. And yeah, so that's where I'm out in the world.
Right.
BHB, Beating Heart Baby, is out in the world right now. Get it from your local bookstore if you want to. It is not indebted that much to Louisa May Alcott, but you know, I'm sure somewhere along the way, it's like if someone wanted to build one of those Charlie Day meme charts of how they can be related.
So I mean, it's not indebted to Little Women, but it's a lovely YA novel, YA/NA-ish, about a trans boy and his queer friend who kind of meet on the internet, fall apart, come back together. And it has been widely acclaimed, justly so, including by yours truly. So please check that out. Check out Beating Heart Baby wherever you get your books. As always, I'm your host, Peyton Thomas. You can buy my book, Both Sides Now, wherever you get Beating Heart Baby. Pick them up as a combo, maybe. And you can find me online at peytonthomas.ca. You can find us on Instagram at Joe's Boys Pod and join us there for all kinds of fun conversations. Give us your thoughts on the Kylie Jenner, Timothy Chalamet situation, if that is still happening. I don't think it is or ever was. That's my tin hat. But thank you so much, Leo, for being here. This was lovely.
Yeah, thank you. Fortunes of war can change their